Chapter 7. Acheron. Chris did not see Mary before the Maverick left for the Forlì system, even though he knew he probably should have. When the moment came to depart, Chris found he couldn't bring himself to face the lovely protocol officer. Chris knew his actions were dangerous and risked alienating her the more he continued to behave this way. There would come the point Chris would push her so far he would never get Mary back, but he possessed no will to keep it from happening. Buck was not at all pleased to leave the Fiorina system with a substantial number of the senior staff absent. However, he understood subordinates could carry out the mission in Forlì just as well as the bridge officers. In all honesty, if the captain was determined to stay, then Buck would prefer him to be surrounded by officers who would be unintimidated by his rank. Wynn, Julia, Alex, and Ezra respected the chain of command, but they spoke their mind if Chris embarked on what was potentially a hazardous course of action. With them around, Buck was confident of Chris's personal safety. Everyone took a moment to watch the Maverick making its departure. The great ship offered a spectacular view as it sailed across the indigo sky, the dark canvas of space a stark contrast against the light blue tinge of its hull. Chris felt his insides hollow a little at watching his ship leave without him. For the first time, he questioned his reasoning to stay when he should be on the bridge of the Maverick taking her to face whatever waited in the Forlì system. However, the insatiable desire to unlock the secrets of the Sulaco and Ellen Ripley soon returned with a vengeance. After the Maverick's departure, everyone returned to their assigned tasks. Wynn, eager to take the drop ship out for a spin, helped Julia as she went through the ship's systems, examining every aspect of the old transport before she gave it any flight clearance. As enthused as she was about working on such a vintage piece of machinery, she would not consider letting it out of the Sulaco until she was absolutely sure of its passenger safety. This meant hours of work ahead, and Chris wondered if Wynn's patience would last that long. It was probably why Wynn was helping Julia. Ezra was presently examining the length and breadth of the ship with the four security officers he had sent for from the Maverick. Although the security chief would have liked to have had Lieutenant Katavit with him on this mission, Ezra would not be content with anyone stepping in for him during his absence on Maverick. Still, he took the best officers under his command instead of Katavit himself. Lieutenant Atwater and Collins were seasoned officers, and though Ensigns Angel and Christie were young, they were sensible enough to think first before acting. However, despite his determination to check out the ship thoroughly, he had to be realistic. The Sulaco was a mile across with nowhere near the technology that allowed the central computer to monitor the ship's internal systems, as done on the Maverick by its own computer. Thus, Ezra's search of the vessel had to be done the old-fashioned way, and that was a lot of ground to cover, with endless conduits, ventilation grills, shafts, and narrow openings. Alex, in the meantime, confined herself to the Sulaco's bridge, viewing all the data to be collated from the personal recorders of the Colonial Marines. From what she had learned, most of the Marines died on the surface of that barren world. Once she finished viewing all the recordings, Alex began piecing together a coherent timeline of events. After what seemed like hours upon hours of analysis, Alex finally reached a point where she was confident enough to provide the captain with an accurate picture of what took place on LV-427, not to mention a description of the creature encountered that caused so much destruction. Being a science officer, accustomed Alex to seeing all kinds of life forms, intelligent and non-intelligent. While some life forms should be viewed with caution, she never encountered one that scared the hell out of her. Until now. Even with all the worlds they charted and visited, the Federation had encountered nothing like Ripley's alien. The Xenomorph, as the Marines called it, could have stepped out of a Lovecraftian nightmare. She wondered how it must have been for the Marines of the Sulaco to descend into LV-427 expecting to rescue colonists, only to be confronted by these horrors. She doubted Starfleet officers of today would have reacted better. As a scientist, she suspected this was likely not a carbon-based life form but silicon. Silicon-based life, though rare, existed, and she could adjust the tricorders to detect it if required. James Kirk, the first to encounter a silicon-based organism, made similar adjustments to his tricorder to find the Horda, a species that would someday become a member of the Federation. Alex doubted these xenomorphs would be so enlightened. Alex also examined the crew manifests and reviewed the internal surveillance tapes of the Sulaco. She quickly studied the hull of the remaining dropship, hoping it might explain what happened to its sister ship. After gathering all available data on board the Sulaco, Alex was finally ready to deliver her report to the captain. The senior staff of the Maverick gathered together in the mess hall at Alex's summons while the security officers continued their sweep of the ship. Despite the vastness of the search area, Ezra refused to let his guard down, and after what Alex saw on the tapes gathered from the personal recorders, she was rather glad for his vigilance.
So, you've completed your analysis?
Chris asked from his seat around one of the long tables they occupied. There was a hint of impatience in his voice, and Alex guessed he was eager to hear what she had uncovered.
I've reviewed all the tapes and put them in order. However,
Alex added, meeting his gaze,
I can only speculate in some instances given the lack of evidence, so keep this all in mind when I make my report.
We are all ears,
Ezra remarked with an encouraging smile.
Thanks.
Alex threw the chief security officer a grin and turned her attention to her audience. Wynn winked at her from where he was, reinforcing Ezra's vote of confidence with a more personal display meant for her as more than just the science officer. Clearing her throat, Alex began.
From what I've been able to determine, it appears the Marines left the Sulaco in one of two dropships on board, bound for LV-427, or in this case, Akron, as it was now named. The equipment inventory confirms this. The squad deployed planetside from the dropship using an armored transport called an APC. It's a small terrestrial vehicle, fully armored with titanium shielding and capable of carrying the entire squad over short distances through the most adverse landscape.
That didn't come back either.
Julia saw no evidence of the transport in question, though she suspected it shared its fate with the Marines in the world where they had died.
No.
Alex nodded grimly, perfectly aware of why not.
The Marines were deployed to the colony of Hadley's Hope and carefully penetrated the complex to assess the situation. The colony appeared deserted. This mining facility possessed a remarkable technology for its time, an atmosphere processor. They built the entire colony around the nuclear-powered processor, which was supposed to make a limited oxygen atmosphere more hospitable to humans over decades. It was a forerunner to the environmental landscaping we now perform before colonization.
If I recall correctly, those processors were often dangerous because of the nuclear component.
Yes, they were.
She nodded, impressed by Chris's knowledge and supposed the captain could be a veritable fountain of surprises when he wanted to be.
Anyway, not to digress.
She returned to the subject at hand because she was certain Chris was more interested in the Marines' experiences on Acheron than the atmosphere processor's details.
The Marines found the colony deserted and swept the living facility and the colony command center. It was during this time they discovered Rebecca Jordan. She was 8 years old, hiding in the facility's ventilation shafts and access tunnels. Apparently, her size made it easy for her to fit into the small spaces, and this was how she eluded the fate of the other colonists.
My God.
Julia whispered, aching for that little girl lost in time and history.
The poor thing.
Well, judging from the images taken from the recorders, the little girl stayed mostly with Ripley. Since they were only survivors, they understood the situation better than anyone else.
There was a moment of silence as those in the room imagined the bond that must have existed between little Rebecca and Ellen Ripley. Two tragic souls finding comfort and kinship in the endurance of their private hell. It made sense. If Josiah was present, he would have a technical term for it.
Go on.
Chris prompted her quietly.
Rebecca could tell them very little, and in the girl's state of mind, which was to say understandably traumatized, the Marines chose not to press her too hard for information. No bodies were in the facility, but the colonists clearly uncovered the derelict ship Ripley and the Nostromo stumbled upon.
Alex said with a pained sigh, and a soft hiss followed the room as everyone grimaced, saddened that Ripley was right about her fears.
There were alien spores in the colony laboratory, and a report revealed the attempt to remove the spore surgically from an infected colonist resulted in his death. There is also evidence of acid burns in the complex. They barricaded several sections from the inside. These did not hold. However, because there were no bodies, the Marines traced them through personal data transmitters every colonist had surgically implanted. The trace showed the colonists gathered at the atmosphere processor under the primary heat exchange.
An unfortunate location.
Ezra winced.
If I am correct, the weapons of the time used projectiles. Had they fired any of them while under the primary heat exchange, they
would have ruptured the coolant exchange.
Julia finished for him.
They could have blown themselves sky high. Those atmosphere processors were pretty formidable. We're talking about a blast radius of almost 55 square kilometers.
Fortunately, that didn't happen. The Marines realized the potential and went in there with flamethrowers. They found the colonists, or what remained of them.
Alex paused a moment as she remembered the nightmarish images of bodies suspended against the wall, forced into a terrible tapestry of agony and horror beyond imagination, of limbs broken to fit a grisly mosaic.
"The aliens got them,"
Wynn said matter-of-factly. It was not even a question.
"Every one of them. The xenomorphs used the colonists as hosts. The images I saw revealed an open egg in front of every colonist. They all had the same wounds, sternum exploding outward."
"Jesus,"
Chris whispered. What must Hicks have thought when faced with all that carnage? He supposed he would never really know, even if he could make an educated guess.
"This is where it gets vague,"
Alex resumed her narrative after that momentary pause.
"It appears one colonist was still alive. The Marines found her just in time to see the alien emerge and reacted by incinerating the thing. Unfortunately, these creatures can put themselves in hibernation, and the sudden commotion woke them all up. There were about 150 colonists, so assuming everyone was implanted, that number corresponded to how many aliens there were. As far as I can tell, only 7 Marines survived the initial encounter. Out of the 7, 2 life signs did not last more than a few hours. However, these signs were very irregular, and I can only assume this was mostly because they were being immobilized the way Kane, the infected member of the Nostromo, must have been during embryo implantation."
"What a way to die."
Julia gasped beyond horror at the nightmare those poor souls must have suffered in their last hours.
"What about the others?"
Chris asked. 7 was much more than the 3 ejected from the Sulaco much later.
"Well, other than the 2 that were cocooned, the other life signs that ended shortly after belonged to the pilots, Pharaoh and Spunkmeyer. Spunkmeyer first, and then Pharaoh."
"That is too much of a coincidence,"
Ezra pointed out.
"Both pilots being killed at the same time?"
"Could it have been at mid-flight?"
Wynn asked.
"That might have explained what happened to the other dropship."
"I think it was. The Sulaco registered an enormous explosion on the surface the same time Pharaoh's life signs terminated. I think she died either piloting the dropship, possibly after it had already taken off. After the disaster in the atmosphere processor, it would make sense for an evacuation order to be given. During the takeoff procedure, something caused the dropship to crash, killing both the pilots."
"So the survivors were trapped there,"
Chris concluded.
"More or less."
Alex shrugged because the information after this point became limited.
"I've confirmed the second dropship, the one on board the Sulaco, was launched via remote control to the planet's surface some hours later. The transmission came from a colony transmitter, so I assume what remained of the landing party probably retreated to the colony complex. At the same time, they tried to bring down the second dropship."
"They must have succeeded. 3 of them made it back here."
"Well, the dropship did land on the planet, but I went over the hull a short time ago and found residual scorching and radiation levels corresponding with a 40 to 50 megaton nuclear blast. The first explosion recorded by the Sulaco was nothing like that, so I believe when the dropship crashed, it damaged the atmosphere processor. Those atmosphere processors were state-of-the-art technology for their time but still limited. A large enough detonation near the core could cause emergency venting."
"So they got away before the blast, but only 3 of them reached the Sulaco,"
Ezra mused.
"Tragic."
4, actually,"
Alex said suddenly.
4?
Wynn exclaimed.
"What do you mean, 4?
"Remember, we kept seeing the reference to a synthetic on board."
"Yeah,"
Wynn nodded, recalling.
"I was going to ask you about it. What's that about?"
"I think they were referring to an android."
"You mean a Prisum model?"
Julia sat up immediately in excitement.
"Yes, I mean a Prisum model. During the eugenics and Third World Wars, artificial intelligence was used more extensively than now. These androids could mimic humans perfectly and were intended to replace them for deep space missions. Humans would not have to spend months in hibernation during space travel. Engineers of the time made incredible strides in robotics, far beyond what we've now developed. The earlier models were different internally but were near indistinguishable from humans. Later models were designed to the genetic level. Cut them open, and you would have to put their organs under a microscope to know they weren't real. That's how advanced it was.
Jesus,
Wynn exclaimed.
How come we don't have them now?
Paranoia,
Chris answered, having heard of the androids of the 21st century from his studies.
By the time the Optimum movement came into being, the new regime saw the androids as remnants of the multinational era. They ordered everyone destroyed. Not only were the models eradicated, but all the research work and engineering details to produce them. The movement destroyed 200 years of robotics research. By the time the Third World War had ended, no one could build one, even if they wanted to.
It's why Nunyan Sung had to start from scratch when he built Commander Data of the Enterprise.
Julia explained before turning back to Alex.
So you're saying there was a synthetic on board the Sulaco when the EEV ejected?
Yes, we have no evidence the EEV made it to Fury 361 intact. But if that ship crashed there, the synthetic might have been on board.
You think it's still on the planet?
Chris realized what had captured Alex's attention so profoundly.
Why not? The facility shut down shortly after the EEV's arrival there, with the only prisoner surviving whatever took place there evacuated. What's the point of taking the EEV wreckage back to Earth? Chances are the company would want what took place at Akron kept a secret, so they would not want any evidence of their complicity to survive. I say they would have left it on Fury, and if that was the case, what's left of the synthetic might be down there, too.
That's a long shot,
Julia remarked dubiously.
I know. But if it's down there, then we have an actual eyewitness to everything that happened, not to mention the only artifact of 21st century robotics in existence.
Don't you just love her when she's all excited?
Wynn teased.
So it all comes down to us getting down there.
Chris remarked after a brief pause following Alex's report.
More or less. We've gone as far as we can go on this ship.
How far away are we from having that dropship prepped for launch?
Chris turned to Julia and Wynn.
A few hours. The dropship is in good shape for its age. Most of what I have to do now is diagnostic.
Are we really going to take that relic down to the surface?
Ezra said distastefully, honestly wishing the idea was not being taken seriously.
Live a little, Ezra.
Wynn quipped, more than eager to take the ship out for a flight and not about to let Ezra cast any doubts in Chris's mind regarding its sensibility.
It's perfectly safe.
Julia assured him before giving her lover a devilish look.
Besides, you know I won't let you get on any ship, which I think is unsafe when you could plunge through the atmosphere and burn up into a crispy critter long before you even felt your skin fry.
Thank you. That makes me feel so much better.
It's going to make you feel even better to know I'm requesting to stay here. Captain, I'd like to continue going over the Sulaco. If we intend to tow her back to Deep Space 5 and eventually return her to Earth, I need to analyze her systems in depth.
Chris did not know whether he liked to be on the surface without the engineer but decided there was probably little need for her to accompany them. Besides, in all truth, he would prefer it if someone remained on board the vessel, especially if some misfortune befell them. With the atmosphere of Fury 361 preventing transporters from being engaged, it was sensible that someone stayed behind with the runabout in the instance they required deliverance. Chris doubted anything would be dangerous at an abandoned prison facility, but there was no reason to leave anything to chance.
All right, Ezra, assign one of your security team to her while she's on board. No one is staying anywhere alone.
Are you sure?
Ezra glanced at Julia anxiously, trying not to let personal concerns cloud his professionalism, but sometimes it was hard to keep both separate.
Yes.
Julia nodded confidently.
I'll be fine. Besides, I get to take this place apart at my leisure. How much fun is that?
This was almost mind-numbingly boring, Lieutenant Atwater thought as he and Ensign Angel walked through the endless corridors running through the length and breadth of the Sulaco. Its designers dedicated most of the ship to the massive engines that took it from one corner of the galaxy to another. It amazed Atwater that ships once traveled this way, spending years just getting to their destination. He supposed part of his problem was the fact modern conveniences spoiled him. How could he imagine a trip of years when warp speed made travel across dozens of light years take only weeks? Still, it did not alter the fact he was required to inspect this ship from head to toe. Unlike the Maverick, with its wide and well-lit corridors, the Sulaco was the exact opposite. Once they moved away from the main areas of the ship, past the bridge, the steel-decked corridors disappeared into ones filled with gratings, overhanging bulkheads, exposed conduits and dark shadows. The walls seemed to close in on them as they walked along the dimly lit passageway, and Atwater wondered if it was just him or if the air seemed stale and thin. He knew it was most likely him because the temperature and the airflow in this part of the ship were the same as elsewhere. Not to mention, his younger companion seemed unperturbed by it at all. Angel, she was called by no other, was of Asian extraction. She was no fresh rookie out of the academy and was edging closer and closer to her first promotion. There was just enough idealism left in her to look upon this assignment with enthusiasm. Give it a couple of years, Atwater thought, and the job would erode it well away. They were traveling down a maintenance corridor near the dropship when suddenly, the path diverged into separate passages. Somehow, he was not up to wasting the time of searching each one together when both could do the same job, since the chief was pretty adamant about leaving no stone unturned during their inspection of the Sulaco.
"We should split up,"
he stated.
"Is that a good idea?"
Angel asked, unhappy about diverging from the chief's orders, even a little. There was something in how he instructed them to stay together which gave the young woman pause, considering Atwater's decision to split up. Ezra Standish was no alarmist, but when he made it clear for them to stay together, there was usually a good reason for it.
"Look,"
he grumbled, showing her the tricorder.
"We've gone through half the ship and spotted nothing so far. Whatever happened in this place, we missed it."
"All right,"
Angel conceded, aware he could make it an order if he wished.
"I'll take the left, and you take the right."
"Good girl,"
Atwater responded with just enough condescension to ensure the young woman would be eager to leave him behind. Without saying a further word, Angel took off down the right corridor. Once she was gone, Atwater made rapid progress on his own. The usual readings emerged, revealing nothing but emptiness. As he progressed forward, nearing the hangar bay, the passage became larger with higher ceilings, with light emanating from the flight deck. He looked down at his tricorder to study the readings of his sweep when suddenly he saw something that made him freeze in his tracks. At first, he was uncertain of what it was, except it was attached to some large conduits, and only a fluke of light allowed him to see anything. He took a cautious step forward and examined the object, which he knew to be some kind of egg. A thin film of moisture rested on its leathery surface. Though it was dark, the translucence of the texture made it possible for him to see its innards. He could make out very little except a vague shape that seemed to pulse with life at his attention. Fascinated, he glanced at his tricorder, wondering why it had not registered. Perhaps the device was malfunctioning, and he shook it for good measure. A hiss that sounded like gas escaping filled the air. Atwater looked up and saw the egg had unsealed. Thick rivulets of noisome material were oozing out of the open orifice, and Atwater stared, mesmerized by the pulsing life piercing its long digits through its biological sheath. It occurred to him at that instant that this was probably what had the chief so anxious and withdrew. The creature about to emerge was not about to take the chance of letting him leave. With lightning reflexes, it sprung out of its fleshy container and landed squarely on Atwater's face. Atwater barely had time to scream and scrambled frantically for his phaser when he felt the creature's tail coiling around his throat and its digits pressing harder into his skull. The sensation of something wet and slimy sliding towards his mouth reduced him to raw panic, but by then, it was too late. Far too late. Chapter 8. Dropship. Time seemed to edge faster to its destination when one did not wish to arrive. Ezra Standish felt this way the closer they drew to the dropship's launch. Although he still lived with the hope the powers that be, specifically the captain, would come to his senses and take the runabout, no reprieve came. As the hour neared their departure, Ezra resigned himself to the situation. He didn't doubt Julia's ability as an engineer when she claimed the dropship was flight-worthy, but his internal senses warned of danger. Although everything Ellen Ripley claimed to have taken place on LV-427 occurred almost 400 years ago and on a planet far away from here, some aspects of this curious tale still felt unfinished. The prison closing shortly after the EEV arrived was too much of a coincidence for Ezra, not to mention the cause of the electrical fire that compelled the ejection. The Sulaco might have been old and constructed with outdated technology, but Ezra didn't have to be an engineer to recognize it was state-of-the-art for its time. Electrical fires did not start without good reason. Furthermore, Ezra had yet to determine the cause of the fire. As a last resort, he examined the cryogenic chamber where the fire occurred. What he discovered on the room floor sent him straight to the captain.
Are you absolutely sure about this?
Chris was aware Ezra had more than a few objections to going to the surface in the dropship and tried to give his security chief the benefit of the doubt.
I would not bring it to you otherwise,
Ezra remarked, hiding his annoyance at Chris even asking him that question. He would have brought nothing to Chris's attention if he had doubts about his information's validity.
There was definite evidence of molecular acid in the cryogenic chamber. I do not know exactly what happened, but obviously, an alien presence caused the fire in the EEV to eject.
Have your security team found any signs of this alien, assuming it exists after 400 years?
Chris continued his discussion with Ezra while the others prepared the drop ship for departure. While Chris was not about to dismiss Ezra, he felt the security chief might be too cautious.
No, sir, but Ripley's narration declared the eggs in the Nostromo's hold could have been there for quite some time. These creatures may be extremely long-lived. It might explain why the prison facility was abandoned.
Ezra.
Chris took a deep breath and tried to hide his impatience with the subject.
If there was a living specimen down there, do you honestly think the Weyland-Yutani Corporation would have left it there? They were determined to gain possession of the alien and sacrifice anyone to get it. I seriously doubt there is anything left there to find. Besides, we are not going down there with old-style projectile weapons. We're going down there with Starfleet phasers. Whatever is waiting down there, we can handle it.
I am certain your ancestor and his companions felt the same way,
Ezra said, conscious he was pushing too hard.
Let's hope it does not end the same for us.
Any other objections, Commander?
Chris ignored Ezra's comment for the sake of their friendship.
No, sir.
Good.
Chris turned away, not wishing to continue this conversation anymore. He knew Ezra was right to be cautious, but they would learn nothing by staying here. Unless they made a surface landing on Fiorina, they would never uncover what happened to Ellen Ripley, and Chris really needed to know. Someone had to learn the truth for justice to be done. For such a noble cause, a little risk was worth the price. It was almost time to leave, and Ezra gathered his security team to select one to remain behind with Julia. After what he discovered in the cryogenic chamber, there was no way he was leaving her on board the Sulaco alone with no protection. Even though the chief engineer was more than capable of taking care of herself, Ezra did not underestimate this threat.
Ty,
Ezra looked at the lieutenant, who seemed somewhat distracted, not to mention he was sporting a yellow bruise on his forehead.
What, pray tell, happened to you?
Atwater shifted uncomfortably on his feet and met Ezra's gaze a few seconds later.
I bumped my head while searching one of the hangar bay corridors. Must have hit it on a large conduit or something. The place is full of them.
Ezra stared at him for a long time, feeling something tickle at the back of his mind. But unfortunately, the captain's behavior had stretched his patience, and Ezra dismissed it.
Next time, be more careful. We will not be near a surgeon for some time. Do you think you are up to remaining on the ship?
Sure, Chief.
Atwater responded, glad to remain on the Sulaco instead of going down to the planet. His head throbbed, and he felt nauseous. Though he could still do his job, he would prefer avoiding the ordeal of landing on Fury 361 on that relic of a dropship the captain insisted on taking down to the surface.
Good.
Ezra nodded.
Engineer Pemberton is staying on board to conduct further analysis of the Sulaco, so you are to provide her with an escort. I do not want her going anywhere on this ship alone. Is that understood?
Something tried to surface through the fog of Atwater's memory, but it refused to come. Something about not being alone. It slipped out of his grasp the more he tried to remember. In the end, Atwater decided if it wanted to stay buried so desperately, perhaps he ought to let it.
Yes, sir. I'll make sure she's safe.
Everyone knew the relationship the chief shared with Julia Pemberton, which gave Atwater a warm feeling knowing the chief trusted him with the engineer's well-being.
I will hold you to that, Mr. Atwater.
Ezra smiled faintly and regarded his team.
The rest of you will accompany the landing party to the surface, Captain Larrabee.
Ezra suppressed his anger at Chris because it did not do to reveal his doubts to security staff.
Believes the facility is unoccupied. While there is no evidence to prove otherwise, we will proceed with extreme caution.
Atwater barely heard the chief's words. His mind kept revisiting the same place since he woke in that empty corridor, feeling this hoarseness in his throat and the painful contusion on his head. Atwater remembered seeing something. He was unsure what came before the world suddenly enveloped him in darkness so potent he could not breathe. Yet instinct told him it was vitally important he remembered before it was too late, if it was not already. The engines hummed as much as something requiring high-octane chemical fuel could hum. It was a harsher sound than the warp engines, which had a more fluid feel, while this had edges and a definite vocal shape. If asked, Wynn couldn't explain it to anyone who wasn't a pilot. Wynn accustomed himself to all the nuances of the dropship's rumble when the engines finally roared to life. Like most vehicles, this one did not appreciate a cold start, so taking off had to be gradual. It did not take him long to study the controls, and though this craft was not a starship, it was still a complex business to master. Fortunately, being Vulcan meant he could process information much faster than humans, and nowhere was the trait more valuable than in such instances. His fingers moved over the controls swiftly, having memorized where everything was. His enthusiasm made him an even faster study than usual because Wynn did not care so much about going to Fiorina but getting there. He knew it was important for Chris to go to the planet's surface and therefore encouraged it, aware something needed to take the captain's mind from the dark place it was presently inhabiting. Although a prison facility with too many secrets of its own was not the ideal distraction. Still, he conducted the pre-flight preparations as he heard the others setting up inside the main passenger bay.
Hey!
Alex entered the tiny cockpit and slid into the co-pilot's seat.
How's she doing?
She purrs.
He grinned, happier now Alex was at his side.
You do love your toys.
She smiled at him as she shifted in her seat, trying to get comfortable.
I might stay up here with you when we take off. It's getting a little frosty back there.
She glanced over her shoulder as if she could see through the closed cockpit door.
Chris and Ezra?
Yes. Ezra's not happy about going down there in this, but I don't think it's just the dropship.
Alex added quickly before Wynn felt guilty about his part in that decision.
I think he's uneasy about what's waiting down there for us. You know Ezra, he sees danger in unanswered questions.
I know Ezra.
Wynn nodded and wondered if he had been foolish about taking the dropship to the surface. He would love to take this craft out, but not at the expense of the crew, especially if Ezra was right and the chief almost always was.
Thing is, he usually has a good reason to be. Maybe I ought to talk to Chris about taking the runabout.
No.
Alex stopped him before he went any further.
I don't think it will do any good. We're barely here for the captain as it is. All he's been doing since we heard Ripley's report is to go through her things and Hicks. It's like he's searching for something.
He needs to know he's doing something right, Alex.
Wynn understood the captain better than anyone because of their close friendship.
He couldn't save Adam and Sarah. Hell, he can't even prove their deaths were not accidental. You've seen the communication logs. He's been talking to anyone who will listen at Starfleet headquarters about the possibility of them being murdered. So far, the most he's got from them is an acknowledgement of something peculiar taking place on board the shuttle before the accident, but nothing more. This is something he can prove, something he can show Starfleet. It's not because he's obsessed. It's because he feels if he can't do right by Sarah and Adam, at least he can do right by those people who died at LV-427.
Alex stared at him and realized how different Wynn was from the shy men who first arrived on the Maverick months ago. He shed the insecurity of being different and now embraced the person he was without fear from the Vulcans or the humans he served with. With his new sense of confidence, Wynn emerged from his shell, and though he would always be a quiet personality, he was also the bravest, most sincere, and loyal being she had ever encountered. Alex took pride in knowing this awakening had to do with their friendship. She supported him through those uneasy months on board the Maverick when they first met. Now it was he who kept the demons away from her. Around Wynn, Alex did not feel the need to be so tough.
When did you get so wise?
We Vulcans mature a lot faster.
He turned back to the controls.
Of course, I still don't get Buck's fascination with seeing a woman in a thong, but I figure it will happen soon enough.
And we all wait in anticipation for that day. So, how long until takeoff?
Another 20 minutes, and we're ready to go.
I'll go tell the captain.
Alex pushed herself out of the chair, uttering a slight groan of displeasure because she was just getting comfortable.
He wants to get underway as soon as possible.
Alex was right. Chris wished to leave immediately. Once Alex informed him the pre-flight preparations were nearly complete, Chris barked orders left, right, and center to prompt the landing party to move at double time. Ezra silenced any opposition to their plans because it appeared the captain was not about to change them on his account. The security chief took personal charge of the weapon cache they would take to Fury 361 because he was leaving nothing to chance. If the facility was abandoned and benign, he would be the first to concede his overreaction. However, if there was something down there, they would at least be prepared to face it. Not only did Ezra fill the dropship with phaser rifles, he also restocked the dropship from the Sulaco's arsenal. The weapons he found in the armory, though primitive compared to the phaser and phaser rifles he brought from the Maverick, were still very effective. The lack of atmosphere in the ship kept the weapons well preserved, with no effect on the metal or any of the chemical compounds making them function. Ezra checked each one carefully before putting them inside the dropship, as a contingency should anything go wrong. For the duration of their pre-launch preparations, Ezra and the captain gave each other a wide berth.
"I'll be fine,"
Julia reassured Ezra as he was about to board the dropship with the others. She could see just how uncomfortable he was about having her stay here through his stoic mask. Since their encounter with Q, where Julia had been for a few hours dead, Ezra was doubly protective of her. While Julia remembered nothing of this, she could not ignore the reality that she had been dead to Ezra and her friends. She couldn't imagine how that must have felt.
"I promise."
She took Ezra's hand and pressed it to her heart.
"I won't go anywhere without Mr. Atwater here."
She glanced at the somewhat pale lieutenant who offered Ezra a salute to assure the chief Julia was safe in his charge.
"See that you do,"
Ezra said gruffly, not wanting to fuss but could not shake his dread about this whole situation.
"Julia,"
Chris made himself heard as he ushered the rest of the security team into the craft.
"You sure you're going to be okay here?"
"Like I said, Captain, I'll be fine. You guys get going. Alex, lend us that synthetic."
"Count on it. We can write our paper together."
Alex winked as she walked up the ramp.
"Captain, I'm going to take the co-pilot's seat if that's okay with you."
"Sure, go ahead."
"Hey,"
Wynn's voice spoke up through the comm badge with more than a note of playfulness.
"Do I have to honk the horn? Daylight is a-wasting."
A small ripple of laughter followed, and Chris rolled his eyes.
"Hang on to your britches, they're part. We're coming."
"I might remind you, Lieutenant."
Ezra grumbled as he walked towards the ramp after sealing his departure from Julia with a little kiss.
"That there is no daylight on board a spaceship."
"Killjoy,"
Wynn called back.
"Good luck."
Julia waved as she and Lieutenant Atwater watched the rest of the Maverick's crew disappear up the narrow ramp into the belly of the dropship. She could see Wynn through the cockpit window. The helmsman smiled and returned her wave just as Alex placed herself in the co-pilot's seat. Despite herself, Julia felt a sense of loss at not accompanying them and knew she was being foolish. She had work to do and probably would not even have time to miss her friends and Ezra. Besides, they would be back before she knew it.
"We're in Vin,"
Chris told Wynn through his comm badge after pulling the ramp and hatch close, sealing them inside.
"Everyone strapped in? This will be a bumpy ride, so I'm not going anywhere until everyone is secured."
Last to be seated, Chris fastened the safety belt around his body and noticed everyone else checking their fastenings following Wynn's order.
"We're secure,"
Chris spoke up on their behalf a moment later.
"As much as anyone could be in this crate."
Ezra frowned.
"Where's your sense of adventure, Chief?"
Lieutenant Sue Collins grinned at her commanding officer. The blonde was a veteran security officer Ezra rescued from a lesser assignment on a colony post and was one of the few people who ever played him to a draw. Her quick thinking secured her a place on the Maverick, and Ezra liked her because she was never afraid to speak her mind, although he had yet to decide if this was a good thing.
"I must have left it in my other uniform,"
the security officer remarked dourly.
"Prepare for drop sequence,"
Wynn announced, and everyone fell silent with anticipation. Massive clamps gripped the dropship firmly and moved it with a loud hiss, shaking its passengers in their seats as they accustomed themselves to the forward momentum and the deafening screech of machinery overhead. The ship slid along the enormous titanium rails, away from the berth it had remained for 400 years. The rails carried it smoothly to the other side of the deck, towards the drop chute in the center of the hangar floor. Julia and Atwater would now continue their observation of the craft's departure from a pressurized viewing room on the other side of the hangar wall. The dropship reached the chute door. Previously, the chute was nothing more than fine seams against the steel deck. The clamps holding the small craft came to a standstill with a sudden jolt, prompting the previously unseen doors to slide open loudly. As the cabin depressurized, the parting doors revealed the sight of Fiorina below them. Wynn began the countdown.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, marks away.
Wynn's voice projected nothing but Vulcan calm, even though everything happening after would not be. The clamps released the dropship, creating a tremendous explosion of sound as the vessel plunged through the floor into the air below. It would fall for several hundred meters before the engines engaged and continued to the planet under its own power. To Fury 361 and all its secrets. Chapter 9. Fury 361. The dropship entered the atmosphere of Fury 361 to reveal the planet was no less redeeming than it was from space. Penetrating the thick shield of cumulus encasing the world, the skies were just as gray and dour as the clouds left behind. The landscape below seemed colorless, making it difficult to tell where Fiorina's choppy seas ended and where the barren landmasses began. Both looked painted with the same palette strokes, and one could imagine how easy it was for those early surveyors of Fiorina to conclude the only appropriate use for it was as a prison. The dropship performed remarkably well for a craft not seen use in almost 400 years. Still, the ride from the Sulaco was anything but smooth. This was to be expected after such a dramatic ejection from the ship. Once it entered the atmosphere, the turbulence eased despite the gale outside. Relentless storms hammered the surface with unforgiving intensity across the entire planet. The climate of Fiorina was an unholy mix of rain, humidity, and wind, creating a soup of sweltering heat the away team could feel before they even stepped out of the dropship. Thanks to the coordinates provided by the Sulaco, the dropship had no difficulty honing in on the EEV's exact landing site at the prison facility. Programmed to seek human civilization for the benefit of its passengers, the EEV successfully completed its mission despite its hazardous trip through the atmosphere. Fortunately for Wynn, who was accustomed to flying a starship through everything from gravimetric disturbances to neutron stars and black holes, this was moderately challenging, nothing more. Their first glimpse of the prison came as the dropship began its descent. Despite the closure of the mining facility, the abandoned foundry and steel works remained. The prison was only a tiny part of the complex, with more of the space taken up by the commercial operations of the mines. Poor visibility because of the pouring rain and fog prevented a good view of anything beyond the immediate area. Even the landing pad was located well away from the mining center and a short distance from the prison. Landing struts extended outwards as the craft slowly descended onto the paved landing pad, now overrun with cracks from centuries of disuse and neglect. They dug into the crumbling tar, its weight crushing everything as far as it would go before the dropship steadied. For a few seconds, the roar of powerful engines drowned out the sound of the wind, its rumble echoing through the prison's empty rooms and silent corridors. 20 minutes after the ship landed, the hatch hissed open. Chris wiped the rain from his face once he stepped into the open air. He surveyed the area and saw nothing to change his view from above. Only now, he experienced it firsthand. Rain was coming down hard, but the humidity made the water against his skin feel pleasant rather than cold. The facility appeared as dilapidated as he had imagined. He could hear the repeated slamming of a door while the window shutters banged incessantly over the howling wind.
Captain,
Alex called out as she descended behind him, her face wrinkled with distaste. Rain plastered her jet-colored hair to her cheeks despite her attempt to brush errant strands from her eyes so she could focus on her tricorder.
There's some kind of airborne parasite in the air.
Ezra Standish followed closely behind after giving his security officers instructions to spread out and conduct a sweep of the area. Angel, Collins, and Christy dispersed across the tarmac, their phaser rifles leading the way as they secured the site for the rest of the away team.
Charming. Are they harmful?
Not really.
Alex continued to study the readings on the tricorder, squinting the rain out of her eyes.
But they feed on keratin, specifically the type found in human hair. We'll have to be inoculated against them, or they'll start feeding on ours.
Can we simply offer them Lieutenant Tanner as a smorgasbord offering? With those long locks of his?
I'll let you tell him that. Are they harmful in any other way?
Chris asked, instinctively wiping his face as if he could already feel the microscopic parasites on his skin.
No. These organisms are mostly composed of keratin. I don't detect any requirement for human tissue. I don't think they can process it.
Ensign Ian Christie, a tall young man almost as solidly built as the Canadian forests he called home, emerged from the nearby building and immediately approached the command officers.
Chief, the primary vicinity is clear.
Thank you,
Ezra responded and turned to the captain.
Shall we, sir?
To no one's surprise, Chris was already on his way there. Not long after, the away team set up camp in what was the warden's office. Some of the furniture remained in the room. A desk covered with dust, upturned chairs, and a filing cabinet tilting dangerously forward because of an open drawer. One broken pane on the glass window allowed in the weather, resulting in the deterioration of everything inside by harsh rain and wind. Trampled papers covered the floor and the warden's personal effects. A dirty coffee mug and photographs were also abandoned. The deterioration of the pictures turned the images into sepia and made every face in the photos appear jaundiced. There was a communications terminal of some sort, but the state of it did not give Alex much hope of gaining anything valuable. During this time, Alex vaccinated everyone from the microorganisms threatening to rob them of hair if allowed to rampage unchecked. Before leaving the Maverick, Nathan provided them every kind of protection he could imagine for this away mission. Alex was grateful to find a remedy in the medkit capable of discouraging their keratin-feeding assailants. At Ezra's request, Alex inoculated the security officers first so he could send them out for reconnaissance while the captain decided his next move.
They left in a hurry,
Wynn remarked as Alex pressed the hypospray to his skin while he read one of the yellowed papers.
They didn't even bother to clear out the files. This looks to be some prisoner's record.
His blue eyes moved over the page.
Clemens, a medical technician or something.
There is no way they could get a doctor out here.
Chris responded automatically.
Too far away from a hollow golf course. I guess they had to make do with what they could get.
The authorities commuted most of these sentences,
Ezra added, reviewing the same papers.
According to the dates, these men stayed in these fair surroundings even after their sentences were done.
That's odd,
Alex commented, moving to the security chief, who offered her his arm without taking his eyes off the document he was reading.
Not necessarily. These men were double Y chromosome offenders, rapists, serial killers, and multi-homicide criminals. Their opportunities on Earth with that attached to their records would have been most inconvenient. They may have stayed simply because it would be less daunting than attempting to reintegrate into society.
Ezra's right.
Chris agreed with the security chief's assessment.
The penal system in those days was next to barbaric. There was no such thing as rehabilitation, not really. Maybe what they couldn't find on Earth was here, where no one could bother them.
I suppose.
She shrugged before finally vaccinating herself. Once she depressed the hypospray's contents into her arm, Alex turned her attention to the computer terminal, believing it might hold some answers to what had happened here after the EEV crashed.
Do you think you can get that thing working?
Chris asked as he saw her pull the CPU from its niche on the wall.
Ew!
She jumped back, startled, as her effort sent some rather large roaches scurrying free from where she dislodged the terminal.
I hate those things.
Wynn looked at her in astonishment.
You're kidding.
The urge to smile was overwhelming, but he held his amusement in check, aware it could land him a knuckle sandwich.
I don't like bugs. Especially big ones.
You are a science officer.
Ezra burst out.
You were the one who dissected that 1-foot slug on Primus II with green ooze all over your hands, and you are complaining about insects, especially tiny insects?
Sometimes I even hate the ones in uniform.
She said sweetly.
As riveting as this conversation is, can we get back to business?
Sorry, Captain.
Alex apologized and returned to her examination of the CPU. Pulling the metal case off the internal works, she examined the components and their state of degradation.
I'll have to change some of these wires. There's been a lot of moisture deterioration. I think the chips are fine though. These things were made to last, especially out here. They're also made to accept generic parts for the sake of expediency. Nothing worse than being so far from Earth and not having any spare parts.
So we'll be able to get something off them.
I think so.
Alex fingered the collection of wires and damaged components attached to the faded circuit board. She was sure she could scrounge the parts needed to repair the device and retrieve the hard disk data. However, if she was unsuccessful, she could still rig the hard disk directly to the tricorder and let the sophisticated instrument create the interface necessary to download all the information. The tricorder's strength lay in its ability as an adaptive interface with even the most complex alien hardware, far more formidable than this relic from another age.
If I can't get this going, I'll just link a direct interface from the CPU to the tricorder and download the information. I would prefer to get it running first, though.
Fine.
Although he was eager to learn what happened to Ripley and her companions after coming to this desolate place, at least there was a great deal of prison to explore, and there was no reason to let the present obstacles prevent him from taking a quick tour.
I'm going to look around.
Where you go, so shall I, fearless leader.
Ezra stood up from the desk he had been sitting on while reading the hard-copied remnants of the prison records.
Ezra.
Chris wished the security chief was not so damn adamant about protocol. Chris wanted to make his explorations alone, but the look in the chief's eyes told him Ezra would not let him wander about alone.
I'll be fine. There isn't anything here to worry about.
With all due respect, sir.
Ezra met his gaze directly, and the set of the southerner's jaw was one Chris recognized as a bald stubbornness to relent.
I do not believe we have the data to make that kind of determination.
Wynn chose wisely to stay out of the confrontation. The best way to remain friends with both men was to remember the chain of command. Both Chris and Ezra were senior officers, and Wynn was not about to meddle in what was clearly an issue of protocol. Besides, he did not think Chris ought to walk around alone either. While his fears were not based on an alien creature jumping out of the shadows, Wynn always favored someone watching the captain's back. Since Ezra had volunteered, Wynn could stay close to Alex because he was not eager for her to be alone either.
Ezra, you sound like my mother.
Well, Captain, your behavior is child.
Commander Standish, come in.
Fortunately, Lieutenant Collins' voice echoed through Ezra's comm badge, interrupting him.
Standish here. What is it, Sue?
We found something.
Well, do not leave us in the dark. What, pray to tell, have you discovered on your wanderings through this charming facility?
The emergency ejection vehicle, sir. The EEV.
Not long after the away team's departure, Julia finally ventured from the bridge. Once she had the place to herself, the first order of business was to run a diagnostic program on all systems on board the Sulaco. Since arriving on the old Earth ship, Julia activated the primary systems like life support and climate control to serve their immediate needs. However, now that time permitted, she could conduct a more detailed inspection of the Sulaco and see how capable the vessel was of making the journey home to Earth. There was no doubt in her mind the Sulaco would make its last trip home after so many centuries of lingering in the wilderness. Historians and engineers would clamor to see the ship, the relic of a bygone era. So few vessels from the mid-21st century survived the Third World War, which was why Z from Cochrane constructed his warp ship from an old ICBM. Julia could not deny she was excited to work on the Sulaco because once the vessel returned to Earth, Starfleet would entrust it to so many others it would be out of her reach forever. Specialized teams would study it, and her responsibilities on the Maverick would ensure Julia would never get the opportunity again. This was her one chance to touch a piece of history, and though she denied herself the opportunity to accompany the captain on his quest to Fiorina, she made the better choice for herself. Besides, she doubted anything Chris Larrabee could find on the abandoned mining facility of Fiorina 361 could compare to the Sulaco itself. Although Ezra had instructed Ty Atwater to stay close to her, Julia had given the security officer permission to get some rest. Shortly after the dropship's departure and Wynn's transmission of the away team's safe arrival at Fury, Julia noticed Atwater did not at all seem well. Confident nothing would emerge from the shadows of the Sulaco, Julia sent Atwater to lie down in the runabout with a promise to keep her phaser close at all times. His color seemed off, and though he tried his best to hide it, she was sure he felt worse than he let on. Her diagnostic of the primary systems showed minor failures in some areas, caused mainly by the lack of maintenance. Interfacing with the computer self-maintenance routine allowed Julia to discern what needed doing. The Sulaco kept a healthy supply of components available in its storage compartments. Like every military organization throughout history, the bureaucracy of the Colonial Marines operated in more or less the same way. Never pay for one when you can get two. When Julia searched for the parts she needed in storage, she discovered a wealth of supplies for every malfunction the Sulaco might experience. Julia collected what she needed and set out on her personal quest to conduct repairs on the systems requiring it. Armed with her toolkit, she began replacing components in sectors needing it. A fuse here, a blown circuit there. The list was really relatively minor. Julia had to commend the original engineers who put the Sulaco together. They built the craft to weather any storm, and despite its age, the Sulaco survived 4 centuries in relatively good shape. Time slipped past without Julia being aware of it. Before she knew it, she had completed all but one task on her repair list. Entering the narrow passageway landing bay, she saw the bright glare of the fluorescent lights from the hangar deck as she stood in the dimly lit corridor. According to her list, there was a blown power relay at the next junction box, explaining why the lights were so dim. In a hall constructed chiefly of cast iron, the poor visibility made it plain dangerous to go bumping into things. Julia found the junction box and spent the next 10 minutes installing new components to replace the burnt-out ones. Her fingers moved swiftly through the tangled wires and switches until, finally, clarifying light flooded the corridor from end to end. It banished the shadows to the neververse between light photons and provided sharp definitions to everything before her. Under the harsh gaze of artificial lighting, the passageway no longer seemed as sinister as before, filling Julia with a sense of pride and accomplishment, until she saw the unsealed egg attached to a bulkhead. At first, it did not register what she was seeing. The engineer in her tried to identify the shape as something connected to the ship. It was not until she drew close enough to stare into the emptiness of the biological container did Julia realize the full magnitude of the situation. The enormity of it lunged out of the darkness and swallowed her whole. Julia's heart pounded loudly in her ears as she studied the unsealed egg, covered in clear, resinous material that reminded her of the lubricating grease she sometimes used in her work. It trickled down the sides of the egg and hardened to the strength of epoxy. Her palms were sweating when she tapped her comm badge anxiously.
Lieutenant Atwater.
There was no answer. Now her fear became palpable. Julia could feel pressing up against her almost as closely as the surrounding corridor. It snaked up her spine like icy tendrils, and, for the first time, she felt an acute empathy with Ellen Ripley's terrifying ordeal.
Atwater.
It occurred to her that Atwater hadn't answered because he couldn't. Concern for Atwater overrode her fears for herself. Julia left her tools where she stood and bolted out of the corridor, clutching her phaser as she emerged into the hangar. The runabout was sitting inconspicuously in the middle of the landing bay, which seemed a great deal larger now the dropship was gone. Julia noticed the runabout hatch, previously opened, was closed. Did Atwater seal himself in sensing danger? Impossible. Ty would never do that without her. Julia raced quickly to the vessel and activated the hatch. The doors slid open obediently, and Julia rushed in without thinking twice. In retrospect, she should have prepared herself. The scene before her was nothing less than grisly. Blood splattered across the panels, the floor, and the seats. Atwater lay on his side against the floor, his face a mask of almost unbelievable agony. His gold-colored uniform was stained red, and lying near his stomach, like a vile afterbirth, was what remained of his internal organs after rupturing beneath the sternum. The scent of blood was so overpowering Julia almost gagged. Runabouts were designed to keep their occupants safe from a warp field. It was as close to a self-contained environment as one could get.
Oh Ty, why didn't you ask for help?
Julia imagined Atwater coming in here, trying to find a reason for his failing health, unaware it was already too late. Instead, agony gripped him as the alien made its ghastly emergence, trapping him and his screams inside the runabout. Through the sheer panic of her thoughts, Julia wondered if he knew what was growing inside him. Growing inside him. The instant the thought entered her head, she heard it. It had no eyes and stood only a foot high, covered in blood and flesh that once belonged to Atwater. With surprising speed, it sprinted straight past her and bared its serrated teeth in defiance as Julia stumbled out of its way in shock. The creature, having waited for its chance to escape the runabout, scrambled out of the open hatch. Julia fired her phaser at the last minute, but her shot missed the creature by a few inches. Trailing blood and ooze as it fled, it uttered an angry screech as it sprinted across the deck. She raced after it, cursing her poor response and allowing it to leave the runabout. Julia exited the craft just in time to see the newborn diving through the open grill leading to a maintenance shaft and disappearing from view.
Damn!
Julia cursed once she was alone. For a few seconds, she could do nothing but chide herself for her lack of performance. Unfortunately, she had no time to waste with self-recrimination because Julia had a bigger problem on her hands. An alien was loose on the ship,